is week 3 of session 6. And as I mentioned in the orientation, I'd like to proceed a little differently today. And that is by having a start with an exercise, and specifically the exercise that was assigned for this week, which is transcendence of pointings. So I'm doing that for a couple of reasons. One is because I have gotten some feedback that people would appreciate starting with some practice, partly as a way of settling in and opening up is probably a better point. That's one reason. Another reason is something I think I've mentioned in class or in the orientations. I think that in one way, well, especially this week, you know, I think that the description, the discussion is very interesting and, you know, helps point toward a really fundamental shift, this idea that nothing is really ever established by something that could do the establishing. We'll find better ways to say that later. But I think that that's a really interesting shift, but it's also possible to leave that on the, you know, on a kind of an abstract level. You say, well, nothing is real, and then you go about your life, you know, and it's hard to kind of give it immediacy. So I think that this practice speaks very directly to that. So that's one reason I thought it would be nice, especially this week, to start with the assigned practice, and we'll see as we go along if we keep doing that. So we're going to start with transcendence of pointings, and I want to say a few things about it before we do the practice, and then we'll give ourselves maybe 5 minutes for the practice. So transcendence of pointings says that it's a follow-up to exercise 7, which is body-mind-thought interplay. And the difference between the two is that in exercise 7, the instruction is to be aware of those different components, the body, the mind, the thoughts, all seen very broadly, and just be aware how they each engage one another. And then in this exercise, we are aware of that same sense of everything pointing towards everything else, but we do that, or we, in exercising that awareness, we also bring in the idea that because everything points to everything else, there is no basis for establishing anything. It's like a dictionary, right? When you look up a word in the dictionary, it points you towards other words, and if you imagine that you don't understand the words in the definition, and you look those up, it points you towards other words, and so on and so on and so on. And the dictionary is just a self-referring system, and it never really gets you anywhere. You know, if it's kind of like if you found a dictionary in a language that you'd never heard of or nobody else had ever heard of, it wouldn't mean anything. It'd be totally meaningless. You know, you might be able to figure out it looked like a dictionary, but there'd be no place to start because it's just everything pointing to everything else. And that's really what it says in the exercise. I wanted to read you just a little bit of the instruction. So he mentions exercise 7. This is on page 205. And then he says, now see if you or a more comprehensive knowingness, and I noticed that Michael and Hayward were starting to talk a little about that idea of a more comprehensive knowingness. I don't think I want to say anything about it now, except to say that the idea is that if you start from the assumption that it's the self that's doing this exercise, then the self is left outside of this mutual pointing. And really, that would defeat the purpose, even though when we start the practice, that's how we're going to do it most likely. But we want to at least leave open the possibility that whatever evidence constitutes evidence for a self could be included in this mutual pointing that we want to transcend. So here's what he says. See if you or a more comprehensive knowingness can apprehend a new form of the mind-thought-emotion-body interactions, a new form which truly embraces the way in which both the mental and the physical are given as existing. So this embracing is actually really important. The notion is that everything is given as pointing to everything else, but usually we look right past that to what's been pointed out, and we just accept the solidity and the substance of what's been pointed out. But we are here, we want to embrace the fact that the only evidence we have is this mutual pointing. So a new form of interaction, the same interaction, but we're seeing it differently. A new form of interaction which truly embraces the way in which both the mental and the physical are given as existing. So what is the way that the mental and the physical are given as existing? What is it that we want to embrace? We want to embrace the fact that it's, as it goes on to say, a subtle mutual pointing. So there's a readout, and in that readout, everything in the readout points to everything else in the readout. Right? So it goes on, a readout sets up a mind and a body which refer or point to each other. Right? So you identify everything, and you do it in terms of the examples it gives here, mind, thought, body, and then you can start from the physical side, it says, and you just go back and forth from point to point. And the pointing, and I'm at the top of 206 now, the pointing doesn't point to anything. There's a move toward establishing, and we kind of race toward that establishing. But in fact, nothing is established because it just points, it's just the identities that we name, that we posit, pointing toward each other. That's the fundamental insight that this exercise asks us to explore. So the mind points to the body, and the body points to the mind. And the self points to the world that the self inhabits, and everything in the world points toward back toward the self as the one that's inhabiting. And the past, or let's say the present, points towards the past and the future. And if our mind wanders off or looks toward the past or toward the future, that points back toward the present. So you can think about a lot of the exercises that we've done in this course as involving this kind of mutual pointing. Right now I'm thinking about some of the time exercises where the past and the present and the future really all engage each other. They all point back and forth toward each other. So that's the fundamental point. Now, there wasn't any discussion. I checked. Nobody really had anything to say about the exercise in the online discussions. So I'm not quite sure how it's going for all of you guys. But let's go ahead and do the practice now. We'll do it for about 5 minutes. And then we'll let that form the basis for discussion for a while, and then we'll move on from there. Okay? So for the next 5 minutes, let's do this practice, Transcendence of Pointings, focusing on this insight that it's all mutual pointings back and forth. Okay, let's do that. Okay, so this is an opportunity for you to comment, and David leaps right in. Okay, David the instant typist. Yeah, hey, Bert. A unity of the known. Okay, so I'm going to repeat this because people's oral comments don't get recorded for some strange reason. Okay, so you're saying as the interrelationship of everything became clear, there appeared to be a certain unity of the known. So is that a unity of the known and knower, or okay. And can you say something? So can you say something about that appearing to be a unity? Is there a field to that, or can you describe it in some way? A stillness and a wholeness. Yeah. Okay. Good. That seems to point in a good direction. Okay. So let's take a look at what David says. He says, "I'm aware of my body as a kind of base field that what I notice around me keeps referring to." Okay. "I'll see the trees, then notice how I feel about the colors that display. I'll see the blue sky through the leaves and then feel a response to the space, feel the energy of my body now. This constant referring back to my feeling solidifies my sense of I am here." Well, that's a nice post, David, partly because it shows how many different things are at work, right? So you start by talking about the body as a kind of a base field. But then there are also your responses to what you're feeling. There's the energy that flows through your body. So body actually seems to refer back more in what you write here to the feelings that move through the body. And some of them have to do with the energy of the body itself, and some of them have to do with an awareness of the feelings that are stimulated or evoked by what the senses provide. So, okay, Ron says, "There was a bizarre sense of what is pointing to what. Nothing stable or fixed." So again, I'm going to ask you, Ron, maybe you could say something about just to describe more bizarre sense. What's bizarre? Did it feel kind of unmoored? Is that what you're saying? Like there's no the lack of stability, and that's what you say. You say nothing is stable or fixed. So maybe that is your description. And that's fine. That makes sense. I'm going to say something that about this exercise that I actually often notice, but it comes up for me particularly strongly, or at least it did right now, with this exercise, and that is that when you start an exercise like this, very often what I do is I look backwards. I look backwards in the sense that something happens, some experience, and then I turn around and look back at what just happened and see whether there was a transcendence of pointing there. I'm not saying that that's the most fruitful way to do it. I'm just saying that's the most natural for me as a way of starting. And then as I get more into the exercise, and of course, 5 minutes is not a lot of time to get more into anything. But as I get more into the exercise, then it shifts from being backward pointing or past centered toward the immediacy of what's going and I mention that because I think that that may come up for other people also. So Ron comments or responding to my question about what was bizarre about nothing being stable or fixed, and he said there seemed to be nothing behind the labels. So did that have a disorienting feeling, Ron? Occasionally people say they feel disoriented by doing a TSK practice, in the sense that, if there's nothing behind the labels, potentially that could be scary. And I've never had that kind of reaction myself, but so I'm not sure what to say about it. So Ron says, no, that wasn't it at all. It was peaceful. Okay, well, we'd like to go that direction, of course. But if you do, you know, if you do ever have a sense of something in a TSK practice disorienting you, or if you're teaching and there's somebody who reports that, actually, I think maybe we could combine that with what David said earlier, that, you know, you can ground yourself in the feeling of the body, that that you might say, well, that's just a label too, right? It's just the label of the body feeling. But I think it can help people ground and be more stable. So I'm talking about a hypothetical, so I won't really pursue it very much. Okay, Bruce says, I had the sense of a twisting, dimensionless Möbius strip. So Möbius strip, most of you know, I imagine, is if you take a piece of paper and you twist it, and then you kind of glue the ends of it together, so a long strip of paper, then it, you can take a pen or pencil and trace along one dimension, and it turns out that you're actually eventually tracing in both directions, or both the front and the back. So you've turned two dimensions into one in a certain sense. And so I can understand why that's a good metaphor for this, because pointing always involves, it seems to me, a duality, right? This points towards that. Here points towards there. Subject points toward world, etc. And the transcendence of pointings would dissolve that separation. And so, yes, when you know, when you look at one thing, it turns out to also be the other thing. So that, you know, again, it's a, that's a theme that you probably recognize from a lot of PSK exercises. Our tendency to divide things up. Rinpoche talks very often about from and to, and also, of course, about here and there. All those distinctions turn out to be really different manifestations of a whole. I think that's fair to say. Okay, let's see. There's some other comments which have scrolled off my screen. Okay, Ken says, I arise in the field. And immediately I arise again and point to and out the just recently arisen I, which in turn vanishes, and so on and so on. Yeah, that's very nice. Maybe that's related to what I was saying. I don't know whether you intended it to be, about looking backward, how I find that I initially look backward in the process. And when you look backward, then, of course, you've also immediately created a dichotomy, a duality between the one who's looking and the one and what's being looked at, which was the previous moment of experience. And so then that then becomes another pointing. You've pointed out the one who's looking along with what's being looked at, and now you can look at that. And so there is this quality of a kind of a loop. There's a book by, who was it who did Gödel, Escher, and Bach? I can't think of his name right now. He wrote a book called, I believe, I Seem to Be a Strange Loop. And I can't remember exactly what he says. I've heard him talk about it, but I can't remember. But we're a little bit talking like that. Everything loops back on itself. And that can be a very liberating insight in the sense that you realize that nothing is established. And that really is what's being pointed to in this whole reading, this whole chapter. So Michael says, I found myself considering how different people are more or less at home with others. A neediness can accompany discomfort discomfort at being the center of attention, as if not being pointed to, leads to a sense of being abandoned or unvalued. That's interesting. That's a whole different dimension. You know, and maybe it's related. Before the conversation, before we started our class today, Michael and Hayward were having an interesting discussion. We had to stop because it was time for the class, but Hayward was talking about a workshop he'd led in which there was a question about, you know, what's the job of the I and what's the job of the me? And I won't try to get into their discussion, but But I tend to think of the me as the one that's pointed to. You know, the I is the one that's doing the pointing, and the me is the one that's pointed to. And that just goes along with grammar. It's not a very profound point. But what the point Michael here is making that is that we have a need, even I guess you could say as a me, to be pointed to. We need to be the one that in some ways is the center of attention. And that's a point that actually I don't think it's discussed in TSK that I can remember anyway, but it seems like a really interesting and important point to consider. The obvious example that comes to my mind is children, right? Because at a certain age, children just always want to be the center of attention. My sense of that has always been that they realize, you know, for a long time, they are the center of attention pretty much when they're babies. And then they feel that slipping away. Well, that's right. That's really what I'm saying. When I say center of attention, is there a distinction there between being the object and the center in your mind? Yeah. So the me you're saying is reactive. The I organizes and the me reacts and is the object of attention. I'm happy to use that language. But Michael's pointing out it's not just children. It's just what comes to my mind. So there's we all, to some extent, maybe have a sense of needing to be the object of attention, needing to be recognized. I'm going to make a reference here to philosophy, which you don't need to, you know, you can ignore. I mean, it's not important to think about this in terms of Western philosophy, but it's just something I remember from graduate school, which is that Hegel, who's very difficult, one of these Germanic philosophers who's quite difficult to read, but he makes a point that then became extremely important for Marx, which is that in the relationship between master and slave, that's the model that he uses, the slave is really the one that has the power because the master needs to be the object of attention. The master needs to be treated as a master in order to feel at home in the universe, you could say. So if you think of that as the I, the I needs to be acknowledged or appreciated or pointed to. So this transcendence of pointing, it's an interesting way of taking the exercise, because it may be that if we really can let go of that sense, that need to be for something to be pointed out and therefore to become substantial and solid, we would also be undermining the commitment to a self. But I don't want to pursue that any further, except I didn't really finish Michael's note here. He said, personally, I feel more at home with others, but less dependent on their opinion of me. I wonder if this reveals more comfort within my own mental, physical pointing, and therefore more able to complete circles of communication with others, as if there's more room in a field of mutual pointing. And Ken says, I'm not positive with reference to this, but maybe, he says, yes, such a process. And I do think it's really interesting, you know, so to continue with the theme we've just been talking about, if you let go of the solidity of what's pointed out, if you transcend pointings, then it may make your being in the world, you know, your situatedness, much looser and freer and more open. I haven't really explored that, but that's what some of your thoughts here are suggesting, and that seems really interesting. Okay, Sudhi says, and I think this takes us in a little different direction, the ultimate meaningfulness of the whole does not fit in language, and the meanings that can be expressed in language are always timed out and specified, far away from the wholeness of inclusivity of all. Right. Before I comment on that, let me just see that Ken says, as in being called out by another. I think that refers back up to Michael's post, so I'm not going to comment on it further. But I want to turn to Sudhi's post for a moment. So this transcendence of pointings is pointing towards the whole. It's definitely not the right language, right? because we'd like to get away from the language of pointing. What we discover in a transcendence of pointings, let's put it that way, is the availability of a whole. And that's what Sudhi is talking about. It has its own meaningfulness, which has nothing to do with the kinds of meanings that you can assign in language. And I think that's right, that we're pointing towards a whole. And I'm going to use that as an opportunity to move into the discussion of the reading that we had for today, because we're interested in what this whole is. The whole, let's say we do this practice, transcendent of pointings, and so things fall away. And if I go back to some of the comments that were made by Ron and by Bruce and others, the distinctions that we ordinarily rely on turn out not to be fundamental, because everything just points towards everything else. But that whole, I think it was Ron pointed toward, one way of reacting to that, or one way of experiencing that, is that it all just turns into labels. And there's a piece, which maybe is close to what Sudhi's talking about as the ultimate meaningfulness of the whole. What we're looking at, and what the reading, I think, takes us toward, and has to do with readouts, which is what's talked about in this chapter, but also with the logos, which is the more general theme we've been exploring here, and which we'll go back to next week, by the way, in the reading from Knowledge of Time and Space. So read out the logos. When you look in that way, that's an invitation to look toward the whole. And it's not a whole that you can specify, because specifying does immediately turn us back toward pointing out. To point out is to make specific, is to say this is this and that's that, and here and there and so on. But it is a whole that it's helpful to contact. It's the whole of the readout, I guess let me just go ahead and take that toward the reading. There's always a context. So if we take a look at the beginning of the reading for this week, it's presented in terms of time, because we're reading a chapter from the time section. But it says that identities and meanings, in other words, really all the things that get pointed out, although that's not what's said here specifically, but I think that's accurate. Identities and meanings all depend on a referring process, a subtle tendency to ground something by placing it in a wider or more general context. Now that wider, more general context, or that whole, let's say, I don't think that's necessarily the whole that Sudhi is pointing towards, which is more like when your usual labels break down. Or that's not quite right. As various people said, it's more like when they become just labels, and you see that they aren't pointing toward anything. And that's what the exercise is inviting us to do. Then you're left with a sense of a whole that has this deep stillness to it. That activity of constantly naming and labeling is really important. And it's important to see how it's just an activity. It's this activity of pointing out, we could say. So Klaus says, finding the whole through falling into holes of insubstantiality. Yeah, so there's a hole here that we do have access to. However, the whole, or here we're just talking about context. I want to kind of connect the two. The reading, this is on page 194, at the top, talks about context and framework. And that context or framework, that's the readout, or the readout in a specification, you could say, of the logos. And that broader whole is what we rely on when we point out. So it's a different whole from the, I want to make sure this point is clear. It's a different whole from the whole that comes when you just see labels as labels. It's a little bit more, I guess you could say it gives us a more conceptual way of arriving at the same point that we may arrive at experientially as well. The conceptual point here is that it's because everything points toward a whole, which is the, let's call it the logos, but we could say the readout. It's because everything points toward the whole that we can point out at all. Because in order to point something out, you have to be able to do it within a context. It's like that dictionary that I was talking about at the beginning. You in order to define a word, you have to have a whole body of words already in place. And really, you could say the dictionary is then the is that whole. It's the readout of the whole. Ron uses points to a point in Buddhist philosophy here, where he says the chatter of pointing is prapancha, or papancha in Pali, conceptual proliferation. And when you challenge that and you see through it, there's nothing to rest on. Yeah, I think that goes back again, this no basis, nothing to rest on, goes back towards what Sudhi said about the whole. I'm trying to come at that in a slightly different way by saying that the whole that will help us see how all this gets constructed and put together is the whole of the logos. And of course, the word logos is sometimes just translated as word or discourse. So the points are all related to each other. It helps to be able to see how that whole gets constructed and how, because of that whole, we insist on things being fixed in a certain way, which means that we can't tune in to the knowing that's actually active, that has to be active, for the whole to come into operation. So that's what we were talking about a week or two ago, knowing with the knowing of the logos. So let's go back and look at a couple more comments. Michael goes back to Klaus's question about falling into the whole, and so whole now in the sense of an opening. And he says, Klaus, do the holes in Swiss cheese express the bubbling up of an airy, insubstantial wholeness? Well, that's nice. And Swiss cheese is good. And Rinpoche somewhere in one of these readings talked about the bubbles in rushing water. So in a stream, there are these air bubbles that form. But you can't really separate out the bubble from the water. You know, the two arise together. And I think that may be this insubstantial wholeness, Michael, that you're pointing towards. So Sudhi's asking for some clarification here. When I speak of the logos, am I talking about the relative whole? Yeah, that would be one way of talking about it. That would be one kind of language. In other words, it's not the whole that comes when you let go of all the labels, you let go of all the pointings. It's the whole that makes it possible to have pointings. And so it's kind of a transition. It's a way into that. And that's really, I think, part of what we're exploring here. So Ken says, and I think it goes to the same issue, why can't the whole be simply another item or feature of a readout? And I think that's right. However, well, let's leave that. And Ron thinks, yeah, that's a good question or a good way of saying it. So let's look at that. Why can't the whole be simply another item or feature of a readout? It can. And you know, you could look at the whole that gives something that, that gives coherence to any particular item. So, you know, desks, you could say, take their meaning from a certain sense of how we can operate, what it's like to walk into a room and have a desk there, and what kinds of activities we're likely to perform. All of that fits together, and if you trace it back, keep tracing it out, you come to, you could say, the readout or the logos. The suggestion or the invitation that, that Rinpoche is giving us, it seems to me, and I've already referred to it when I talked about knowing with the knowing of the logos, is that we would like to be able to see the setting out, setting out the activity of the logos. We'd like to be able to let that knowing be available. So you can, there's a whole that you can refer to as an aspect of the readout. But there's the readout itself. It's a little bit different. And that, you know, if you make the readout an object within the readout, that's possible. But I'm trying to point toward a kind of knowing here that is not the usual knowing of pointing out a particular entity within the readout. It's the knowing that reads out, or as it says here, it doesn't exactly say it here. There's an interesting distinction, and people comment on this a little bit during, on the website. There's the question of pointing out. There's the activity of pointing, and in the previous readings in the past couple of weeks, we've talked about the act of positioning. So there's the taking a position. And then there's the act of positioning. And the act of positioning really depends on this broader knowledge, or opens the possibility of connecting with this broader knowledge. And I think the same thing is true with pointing out, except that pointing out is already, you could say, too late, because something has been pointed out. It's been singled out in the act of pointing. And that's why we aim for transcendence of pointings. So this seems a little bit, I feel like I'm making it a little more complicated than it needs to be. But so it is. Let's see. Maybe other people's comments here can help clarify it. So let's see. So Sudhi asked about, speaking of the relative whole, and we've talked about that. I don't think Ram was replying to that, but Ram says here, not an error to the extreme of no whole, which is why I like what he, Rinpoche, says about balance. You'd have to give me the context, so I'm not going to try to say anything else about that. Sudhi replies to Ken's question, and Ken's question was, why can't the whole be simply another feature or item in the readout? And that's something that I was trying to go to. So Sudhi responds to that, when we are spontaneous and expressing the message of time, not the ego self, then the message of the logos is expressing the more inclusive whole. I think that's well put, and that really is the distinction that I'm trying to make here, is that we would like to be able to know with the knowing of the logos. I'm going to use that phrase because I think it captures something very important. And when we do that, then that, you could say, almost spontaneously takes us into the realm of a whole in which there isn't even a whole to be pointed out. Go back to that point and probably relate to Ken's question as well. So, and Bruce's point here, I think, goes to that. It says, It seems any identified hole, Bruce says, it seems any identified hole would be given by a readout. Yeah, that's what we've been looking at. But some would consider this to be a counterfeit hole. An authentic hole is like active absence. That's a nice phrase. I like that. I think it speaks for itself, so I'm not going to try to say any more about it, also because we're about out of time. And Ron says that in the commentary on page 206, this is the commentary to the exercise, I think, it says, and he's quoting, it's possible to bring the higher and lower. Oh, okay, he's relating to balance. It's possible to bring the higher and lower into relation with one another in a way that is healthy. So, yeah, I think that relates to what we're talking about here. The logos is you know, you could say that you could look at it and say, well, this is how everything gets set up, everything gets frozen, because it gets turned into a readout, right? And the readout is fixed and we're stuck with it, or a logos. That is one possibility. The other possibility is to recognize that that's what's happening. And I think I'll go ahead and apply Bruce's term here to recognize that the logos is a whole in the sense of being an active absence. It's not something you specify, but it's the kind of unsaid. And yet it's doing all the same in a certain sense. And so that's why we'd like to be able to get to that, or what's a better way to say that? We'd like to be able to tune in to the saying of the whole, which isn't said in words, which is presupposed, but it's still an active saying. It's absent in the sense that it's not specified. But it's the active reality of our world. Yeah, Edward. I think that's right. And we're talking here generally. So Hayward asked, could we say that the presence, that the logos reveals the presence of time and space? And I think it's right, and I think it's a general, or it's an example of a general point, which is that we're looking at what you could think of as the second level. And the second level is this level at which you could say, everything gets called into being, but it hasn't yet turned into the specifics that it claims to be. So by seeing the coming into being of what is, we free ourselves from the rigidity of the claims to exist that go along with the coming into being. So if we go back to this moment before the solid, the fixed, the rigid, the identified, the labeled, then we are on our way toward an understanding of this incredibly more dynamic and alive quality of, let's say, great time and great space and great knowledge. Okay, let's stop there. That's a lot that we discussed today. Good. Thank you very much, everybody.